Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it possible to find meaning in life apart from any belief that we are the products of deliberate design? Societies the world over have been charmed, comforted, and enriched by stories that explain our consciousness as a special gift from God to humankind. For some people, the emergence of scientific explanations for our existence and evolution severs any connection to the divine or supernatural. But if we owe our existence to a series of cosmic accidents, there is still undeniably meaning to human existence, and it would seem we might need both the sciences and the humanities to understand, describe, and celebrate it. Biologist and naturalist Edward O. Wilson is professor emeritus at Harvard University. His new book is called The Meaning of Human Existence. Ed, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much.
Let's start here by acknowledging that meaning can be understood in a number of different ways. People of faith, for example, typically believe that both humankind and individual humans exist for a purpose.
Well, yes, I think there are two meanings, really, basically, that we tend to use in the English language. The first is the usual, that there is an actor, sentient, usually, but not necessarily. It can be an actor operating according to an instinctive program that produces a process or an artifact, some result. And the other meaning, of course, is that what biologists call the ultimate meaning of biological phenomena, and they also consider the mind and all of its products to be biological. And that meaning, the ultimate meaning, is this history. And it carries with it the recognition that history, that the story of humanity that goes back essentially to the beginning of literate civilization, makes no sense except through an understanding of prehistory, that is, what events caused the origin of humans in the first place, and those stages that we now know led gradually up to the human condition that we possess today. And further, that prehistory, those stages leading up to the actual emergence of a full human species, makes no sense without biology. It is a long and brilliant and engrossing story. And that is the real meaning of human existence, as best as I think we'll ever understand it.
There is something, if you'll pardon the expression, miraculous about the fact that we are here at all and we have the cognitive capacity and self-awareness to recognize that. And it seems no less miraculous even if we take a purely biological view of our existence.
Every species is, in a sense, a miracle in that it is highly improbable that it would be created. On the planet Earth, we have at the present time an estimated 8 to 10 million species of organisms, plants, animals, microorganisms. And every one of them, when you examine it, is truly remarkable in the way it's put together and the way its molecular machinery and process work to allow it the maximum chance to survive in existing ecosystems. Humans are one of about, as best I can estimate, 20 lines. They're the results of 20 lines of evolution through the whole history of life that achieved the condition of eusociality, that is, advanced social organization based upon altruistic behavior, particularly among members of the same group, producing cooperation that gives the group as a whole extra facility in competing with the other species around it.
What's interesting about eusociality, and as you say, there's been 19 other times, mm-hmm. maybe other than humans, is that this has been observed not just in like higher primates. There's crustaceans and rodents and insects. It doesn't seem to necessarily favor those that we believe to have the largest cognitive capacity.
You can say that approach to the crucial pre-adaptation, the adaptation to changes that lead us to the threshold of eusociality, is something of an accident. But on the other hand, it's not, because the pre-adaptation, the final step before all these different creatures, including the human line, took it, and they went into then the more advanced form of organized society, has a single feature in it that we had not appreciated before. It was only when we did these comparative studies across many groups and across literally hundreds of millions of years of evolutionary history, we finally came to understand this, and that is that essentially a solitary individual or a mated pair or a small, less organized group built a nest that was part of their adaptation to rear young. And that in rearing the young, they didn't just put a food supply in, which is the usual thing among animals, but they feed during their evolution the young progressively, meaning that they kept the young in the nest like a bird and went out, got the food, brought it in, and fed them until the young emerged. And as a group, normally that group spread then disperses, as they do in birds, for example. Lots and lots of groups reach that threshold, as have birds, but a very small number then took the next step, which is to cooperate in part through altruistic acts toward one another in the group, meaning that a few individuals at least would take the role that led to a somewhat greater, or maybe in some cases a very much greater, likelihood of surrendering longevity or having fewer offspring, at least. And when that happened, then you could have a division of labor, which gives an enormous advantage to the group. That advantage is the reason why ants, which only originated once in evolution, and termites, which only originated once in evolution, back in the Mesozoic, are the dominant insects of their size all around the world.
So there are trade-offs if you are in a eusocial species in terms of individual survival, but group survival is favored.
Well, yes, if you can get the right kind of group competition, then you're on your way.
I was very interested that in eusocial species, you know, we typically have been taught to understand this because there is the idea of survival of the fittest, and we do things that will allow our own genes to continue. But this requires looking at evolution in terms of both group and also individual evolution or survival.
That's correct. What we haven't done is to link that process of multi-level, you know, multiple-level evolution. That is, the evolution going on due to natural selection of competing individuals within the group. And then at the next level up, the evolution by natural selection going on due to competition between the groups. Right now, I'm working with a group of mathematicians and a few other biologists in reinterpreting this and bringing it a lot closer to the proven principles of population genetics, which is a pretty mature and successful discipline of biology. Add group selection to population genetics. It's the same principle, basically, from genes, mutations, on up. And you have a pretty good fit for competition among groups. Let me just give you the formula, the sort of mantra of this that gets it, I think brings it to greater clarity right away. And that is that within a group, selfish individuals beat altruistic individuals. But in competition between groups, groups of altruists beat groups of selfish individuals. And you can see right away that there's a kind of tension, a dynamic tension between the two levels. And it's in examining the origin of human advanced societies and how we're organized today, you can then deduce, I think, in a straightforward way, why we are so conflicted. Conflicted in our conscience, our internal thoughts and impulses. And we never seem to be able to reach equilibrium, either within a group or within our own minds. It is because of that those two levels of selection in a tug of war with one another.
Because we're always driven to survive as both individuals and as members of these groups that mean so much to us.
Yeah. Well, you can. There are circumstances in which belonging to a group of altruists increases the likelihood of your genes being increased in proportion compared with what otherwise they would be if you were existing as a solitary individual.
How did living together for the first time as hunter-gatherers in our early history help to evolve our social and cognitive capacities?
We start with the pre-humans, and those were the one line, actually, of the group called the Australopith, the Australopithecine primates of Africa. And as far back as almost 6 million years ago, the earliest of these, the most primitive, were a species that made it out of the trees, became less arboreal. Most of these modern anthropoid apes can do that to some extent, chimpanzees to the greatest extent. And but within a very early time, a short amount of time, the earliest of the Australopithecines, shall we say 5 million plus years ago, got much more terrestrial. That is, they could move around much better, and they became close to bipedal. That is, the hands and arms became free as the locomotion was shifted primarily to the legs. And when that happened, a very important step was taken for a mammal, and that is free hands.
And those free hands allow us to develop tools and technologies that otherwise we might not be able to build and use.
That's correct. And you might add one other thing, too. It was a fortunate circumstance. You can call it an accident, but, you know, that, too, probably had a considerable value as an adaptation, that our fingertips be soft and pulpy and surrounded above by a hard nail, but not claws, because that's the form of fingertip that is just happens to be the best adapted for creating artifacts.
And I suppose it's also good if you are caring for an infant that is not fully developed when it is brought into the world.
Well, not necessarily, because lots of clawed mothers and other species can achieve the same effect. But when you're dealing with, say, dissecting a fruit or designing for the first time some kind of an instrument, then it's very helpful.
We're speaking this hour with biologist and naturalist Edward O. Wilson, professor emeritus at Harvard University and author of the new book, The Meaning of Human Existence. You can join this conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Edward O. Wilson, the biologist, naturalist, and professor emeritus at Harvard University. He has a new book out called The Meaning of Human Existence. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. So, Ed, we have individual selection and we have group selection. The benefits of group selection are obvious. There's protection, there's support, there is the ability, if something happens to you, to still have others looking out for your the people that would carry on your line. On the other hand, our need to belong to groups means that we are going to call other people outside of our group. And we, I suppose, have to fight against an impulse to be, say, racist or bigoted, that sort of thing.
Yes, what works so well in driving evolution and bringing groups, individual groups, to great success, usually at the expense of other groups in history and prehistory, today is particularly pernicious and dangerous. It's manifested, of course, in racism, it is also manifested in the deadlier forms of religious faith. All religious faith are based ultimately on a creation story with superstitious, let me put it in this kind of word, supernatural elements. And each one defines itself, the members define it themselves, by a particular creation story of how the world and life came into existence. And they all favor themselves in these accounts. That is, no matter how gentle and peaceable they are in intention, the members do think that their group is superior, or at least their particular creation story. And so it is a sad propensity that we have. We slide into it so easily to develop prejudices, group prejudices of various kinds, but also we find it impossible to authentically bring religious faith together. There is such a thing as religious belief at a transcendent level, and this likely evolved. This is what makes people dream of a divine creator, of life after death, and that could even be unifying to them. But religious faith has hijacked religion, and unfortunate seems to be an unquenchable cauldron of conflict and destructive behavior around the world.
How are we to think about good and evil if we look at our existence as and our behavior as a product of natural processes, which would seem, therefore, to be somehow devoid of morality?
Well, it's a complex business. That's what makes the humanities so creative, spinning stories out of the conflict between the products of group and individual selection, of being able to, and if your group is the United States of America, say a nation, of properly, with respect to the survival of that that group, of treating heroism in war and self-sacrifice of all kinds. But when it is coupled to the triumph of one group over the other, and partly on the basis of perceived superiority in the religious faith that identifies the group, then we are in deep trouble.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now to Jose in Arlington. Hi, Jose.
Hi, I love the show.
Thank you.
I guess my question kind of changed a little bit after listening to the indictments on religious faith. Initially, the question was regarding the emergent nature of the universe, how the entire universe and all its complexity emerged from the initial singularity, and the emergent nature of human consciousness and how the brain isn't one thing, but consciousness emerges from the chaos of all the synapses and prior experiences in our brains. Doesn't human consciousness inherit the chaotic nature of the universe or the meaningful nature of the universe? In other words, if the universe is chaotic, then humans and human consciousness is chaotic. And if it's meaningful, then human consciousness is meaningful. You can't really disassociate the two and encapsulate them.
What do you think, Ed? That's a very interesting question.
Well, it's that the Earth, the universe is not necessarily chaotic. I mean, the one thing that appears to be consistent are the fundamental laws of physics, as best we can hone and measure and use them to measure and describe them. I think, though, that probably on every planet that's habitable by any form of life, there would be very early in the evolution a propensity to form groups because they have such an enormous advantage over solitary populations in so many circumstances. In other words, I don't think there's a kind of principle that leads to higher consciousness, because the ants, the termites, and many of the other of these advanced societies, your groups with advanced societies, really partly because of their small size, have not advanced it much at all in any form of consciousness. It took a big animal going through the same process that some 20 other lines of organisms in the history of life went through to acquire advanced social organization. All the others, it's 19 plus humans, that I've been able to work out. All of those do it by instinct, civilization by instinct, so to speak. Right now, I think it's worth stating, I'm glad you did bring up brains and consciousness. I'd like to make a generalization about this that's important. We're not turning to science as a whole to explain all of the particularities of human existence. We're turning to, well, it's about five disciplines of science and technology, and I'll name them for you. But I'll start by just saying, never, ever ask an astrophysicist what is the meaning of human existence. You have to have one or better a combination of the following: evolutionary biology, the brain sciences broadly defined, now going pell-mell after the grail of the brain sciences, which is the nature of mind. The third would be, of course, archaeology, segueing back when we get past the lines of the depths of the first artifact into paleontology, the study of the actual anatomical evolution of the most successful lines. And then finally, in technology, artificial intelligence and a field most people haven't heard of, but it's growing rapidly, and that's whole brain emulation. And these are two approaches within them of understanding how the brain works. But, of course, they also have a practical goal of creating far superior computers and computing technology and human capabilities simulated over anything that exists today. The reason why that's so important is that the researchers are trying with robots to produce avatars of human thought in them. And that is one important approach to understanding how the brain works.
Is there a place at that table full of very smart scientists for, say, a philosopher or a poet or a painter?
Not in that space of science.
But in sort of understanding and describing the human condition in ways that scientists have tried and or maybe haven't even tried to do.
Well, yeah, it's probably what you're doing is talking about the possibility of unifying science and the humanities. Mm-hmm. And I think, yes, that's possible. I believe that, of course, as our search on into mapping the brain, that we're conducting by mapping the brain, and then we're working out the robot avatars and the functions, and we're beginning to get a picture of exactly what consciousness is, then this is going to have a major impact on the humanities. I mentioned earlier that the conflict between the certain conflict, I would think, in the course of achieving advanced social organization between individual level selection and group selection, with all of the complexities that creates, is actually the substance of the creative arts, depicting the conflicts and the major drives. And when we come to understand more clearly how human existence came into being, then this is going to be an endless source of inspiration for the humanities, all the way from law and the theory of law and public relation, economics, down to the creative arts. The trouble with the humanities today is not a lack of brilliance. It's the fact that they're not rooted. We're in what could be called the natural history phase of the development of humanities, just as after Linnaeus and before Darwin, we were in the natural history phase of biology, describing in rich and brilliant detail what people really do. And the cause and effect that they is expressed is based upon a given understanding about instinct and the nature of conflict, love, and so on. But never, never yet includes an explanation of why it is that way and not some other way, where it all came from. That is what we call the ultimate explanation, and that the lack of that is the reason why the humanities are not rooted. So as the science moves inevitably to try to account for the roots themselves, and as the humanities, I think, deepen and produce in a much more complex and interesting way the description of human behavior, the two will come together.
Do you think, Ed, that we will ever definitively answer the question as to whether free will exists?
Sure. If I try to answer you in any convincing way, I do have a chapter on that, then I would be kind of claiming, well, we've already done it. Well, we haven't already done it, but I believe that as we move closer to the grail, that is the nature of conscious thought, and learn more and more about the centers of unconscious thought and decision-making in the brain, in other words, take the brain sciences further, then I think the question of free will go away. We'll be able to understand it in wholly new terms.
I suppose what gets in the way, though, is our perception that we have free will. Whether or not that is, in fact, the reality, that's how most people feel.
Well, it is, because in my judgment, the conscious mind is simply the playing out of stories with the ego, with the self, always center stage and always the key person in the stories you tell. Whether you're recovering memories conveniently to make the base decisions on, whether you are creating stories ahead of how what you do in different possible lines will have such and such consequences, the whole subject or the whole activity of the conscious mind is the construction of stories and then the dragging of them through emotional centers that create that decision, lean the decision process, which we now know is mostly unconscious, to leans it one way or the other.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Eric in Mesquite. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, what is your projection for humanity's future, given that there aren't any real defined groups anymore, whether it be racial or national? The lines are kind of getting blurred, and we're all kind of becoming one. So what does that mean?
Well, that's true in, national divides. If they remain in position, then they're through global communication and hyper activity in international communication. Those are becoming blurred, but humanity, if you think about it just a moment, have this extremely powerful, intense need, it's an instinct, to form groups. And it doesn't matter whether you're a jihadist Muslim, a devout evangelical in Arkansas, or a rooter for the Crimson Tide. The same emotions will always be felt, and I think we'll always divide ourselves in group, both for practical reasons and for entertainment and also for personal fulfillment and satisfaction. So I don't worry about people all becoming the same thing, same language, same beliefs, same knowledge, and so on.
We are in a position, maybe crudely now, but probably with much greater sophistication as time goes by, to affect the course of our physiological evolution. What do you think will be the result of that?
I don't think much is going to happen for a good long while because we already are probably as far as the machinery we were born with. You know, the digestive processes, the dentition, and so on. To be omnivores, that's one thing that seems to be fairly certain. And I think it unlikely that we will continue to have growth of the cerebrum and the memory storage capacity of our brains. I think what was happening in evolution is that we're becoming homogenized. We're crossbreeding, so that in time, it may, in theory, be possible that you would have the same mix of genes in Lagos, Nigeria, as you do in Beijing.
My guest is biologist and naturalist Edward O. Wilson, professor emeritus at Harvard University and author of the new book, The Meaning of Human Existence. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Harvard biologist and naturalist Edward O. Wilson, author of the new book, The Meaning of Human Existence. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Ed, by looking at ourselves and our own evolution and all of the other animals and creatures that we've identified on this planet, what kinds of conclusions can we draw about what intelligent extraterrestrial life might be like?
Well, first of all, in the vast majority of systems that we discover, Mars included, if there is life there, Enceladus, the moon of Saturn, if we can find it in the plumes of water, heated water there, or Europa, if we can find it in the oceans beneath the great ice shield on that moon, it will be bacterial. There may be higher organisms evolved, but the one thing that you can count on through the galaxy, in my opinion, is that microbes rule. If any level of life is achieved, but then it's halted for whatever reason, then it will be microbial. I've also, just for fun, drawn a picture of E.T. by going over carefully the appearances, the architecture, the anatomical architecture of all the groups of organisms that came out on the land during the Paleozoic era. And the results are really very interesting. We'll find, for example, that they must be terrestrial. I won't go into the argument for this. They have to be land dwellers. They have to They will have all their sensory apparatus, or practically all of the important integrative apparatus, up in a head in the fore part of the body. They will have multiple fingers, but they will have a small number of limbs, and they will be big compared to the other organisms found on their home planet, things like that. I'll hope that Hollywood science fiction scenario writers will pay attention and be careful how they depict their alien invaders in the future.
Stop making movies about giant insects coming to populate the planet, is what you're meaning.
I don't want any octopuses with great tentacles reaching out either. I don't want any telepathic messaging, but I do enjoy each one of these films immensely.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Gary on the line in Denton. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Chris. It's great to visit with you, Dr. Wilson. Pardon me being a gushing fan, but your Sociobiology, the New Synthesis, is the book that most radically altered my world perspective. I just can't say enough good things about you. But I was hoping I could get you to comment on human altruism as it expresses itself regarding other species.
What would I think about that?
Yeah, I mean, how does that work?
Yeah. Well, I think that's entirely possible because one of the results of group selection, it's cleared the air a great deal studying it and thinking about its consequences, is that altruism, real altruism, is a possibility that could arise from group selection, and that it could be easily extended to other species. I think that the closer those species are to us in appearance and behavior, chimps look like us, dogs are practically human in their social behavior, as opposed to a remote, like a scorpion or a poor little ant, the less likely, in fact, it becomes almost impossible to feel in a truly altruistic way toward them. But I think that is something that could be some propensity for that is innate.
It has been astonishing in recent years to learn and really appreciate the intelligence of other animals that previous generations simply dismissed as being certainly not sentient beings, but almost, you know, having no ability to think at all, to have any kind of emotional life. And it seems like more and more we're learning that animals communicate in ways that before we just never imagined.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's why animal behavior studies are so important. We're discovering that in at least large vertebrate animals, particularly mammals, that a repertoire of rational behavior is possible, that often they do have emotions that could be somewhat well compared to our own. And I think the more we study and the more we study our brain structure and the brain structure of the most intelligent animals in the world, the more we'll come to appreciate them. I think there really is their intelligence and their sensitivity. I think there really is a sound basis for a moral concern for the welfare of animals.
I don't want to get too hung up on this, but if there is another planet somewhere in the world that has an intelligent species, do you think it's also a requirement that there be really only one at a time?
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
I think that already happened on this planet. That is to say, when you look at the, even with what's probably very incomplete fossil evidence of the hominidae, you know, the human and human-like species, we already had, as recently as 30 to 40,000 years ago, we already had Homo sapiens, we had the Neanderthals, we had the Denisovians, which may be a distinct species from the Neanderthals, although somewhat similar. And although it's still controversial, it seems reasonable to me that the little people of Florius, the little hobbits, mm-hmm. even though they may have descended from the Homo erectus, but a different species. All those may well have been on the Earth at the same time, but it's probably a consequence of the group behavior at the species level that would induce the first really highly intelligent and very effective competitive species to eliminate the others.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Simon in Dallas. Hey, Simon.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. My question to the guest is that I would like for him to comment on. I've always thought that the universe is like a big brain that thinks, and that's why we are in existence, as humans and all other animals. Now, if that is the case, is it possible that our brains do communicate with the universe, and that's why we have thoughts and imaginations? I would like the guest to comment on that.
I'd like to hear the answer to that, too.
No. I don't believe it. It's lovely. Mm-hmm. But we're beginning to get emanations now from the aforementioned astrophysicists and others that at the quantum level and the simultaneity of events and so on in different distances could mean that there's some kind of a universe-wide connection and causality. I think that indicates some kind of a flaw in conclusions made macro, extended from quantal to universal. I just don't feel that in my bones that something like that is happening.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Carrie on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, Carrie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I am depressed, I guess, and worried about, seems like so many people in our culture now do not accept scientific evidence. There's a great number of people, including members of our political parties in very important leadership positions, that reject science, reject the evidence of science, even the idea of evolution being a fact of nature. And policies are being made now based on ignorance and things that, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency is being dismantled in some quarters when all they're doing is pointing out the evidence of from scientific research on our environment. Are you as depressed as I am about this?
No, because I realize that their armor plating is not stupidity. It isn't the ability to apply rational reasoning and evidence. It is it's group loyalty. I mentioned earlier that that our religious faiths are not what they seem, but they, in terms of their belief system, they're not reasonable. There's no evidence in most cases. Rather, they are the faith that they have, the creation stories and accounts of supernatural events, are what define them. I've always defined different religions and denominations, and it connects them with a group. When you oppose it, then you're opposing their identity and the identity of the people closest to them. So that is the armor that is put up and is going to be very difficult to get around. I don't know how to do it, but just, ridiculing the beliefs of 50% of the Americans is not the way. You just dig them in. You do not subdue a faith by carpet bombing. I remember when I was a little kid in the Southern Baptist Church growing up in Sunday school, I was taught that the world is full of extremely bright and persuasive people, but they are agents, conscious or unconscious, of the devil, and that always they would be attempting to break down my faith. But no matter what happened, no matter what I heard, stay to the faith and hang on. That is the truth, and that is your future. and the meaning of the group that you belong to. And that's pretty much what we're seeing today.
Was it hard for you to walk away from that group in order to pursue your life's work?
No, I was a typical adolescent. I was rebellious. And then when I got to college, I discovered a lot of things, science and so on, that gave me a deeper and a surer sense of meaning. I knew that that the certainty was not likely to be obtained right away. That lack of certainty, that need to learn and understand and keep working at it, is a lot harder than just accepting a blind faith. That's what appealed to me, and it appeals to most people, I think, when they have an openness, any kind of openness of mind.
So you say in the book that only wisdom based on self-understanding will save us. Does that make you more or less hopeful for the human race?
Well, I like to say that I'm hopeful. I have altruistic or optimism genes, but I like to take in tow immediately what Abba Iban, the foreign minister of Israel, said during the 1968 war, one of the, endless and pointless slaughters constantly going on in the Middle East. And he said, when all else fails, men turn to reason. And I have a sense that when the average temperature of the world of surface temperature rises to over 3.6, and we begin to feel the real consequences of it, when we never seem to be able to get out of our brutal and destructive competition between groups and countries, that eventually we will turn to reason.
Looking now back on your long career, do you feel like science is where you imagined it would be at this point in history, or has it come further than you thought it might?
Science is full of big surprises, and they're always delightful. I've been at Harvard for 63 years. They can't get rid of me. I've lived through the discovery of the simple molecular structure of the genetic code, DNA. I've lived through other surprise after surprise in physics, chemistry, and now I'm enjoying the surprising I'm getting from studying the brain sciences and those other scientific disciplines I mentioned. They're going to give us a lot more shocks and surprises, and I hope we find them pleasant.
Edward O. Wilson is Professor Emeritus at Harvard University. His new book is called The Meaning of Human Existence. Ed, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very grateful to you for letting me on.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.